Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Hi, Toby. I'm Dave O'Brien. I work at the University of Manchester, and I'm also currently on secondment to the British government as well.
On secondment to the British government.
Yeah.
Are you a peacekeeper, Dave?
I look, there'll be various things where I assume, Zoom will just automatically edit us out. There'll be, redacting going on, that kind of thing.
I love it. Funnily enough, I recorded something this morning with someone, and suddenly she pointed this out. I hadn't noticed it. On her screen, a little hand, a golden hand, came up in approval. And she said this has happened on a number of recent Zoom calls. I guess it's better than being bombed in a negative way, but still. Well, it's great to see you. We've been good friends from the day we met, which would be about 14 years ago now, I'm thinking, when we
Yeah,
first
must be
met.
actually, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks to our mutual friend Kate Oakley, I think we met. And although we're somewhat infrequently in touch, it's always warm and friendly. And the other thing is, I, of course, stay in abreast of your brilliant work and know what it's saying. But I'd still love to know, to the extent that this is allowed, on this side of the screen, we have the power of scientific Marxism. On your side of the screen, we have the power of King Charles II, or third, I should say. But if you could share with us what is currently dynamizing you, preoccupying you, interesting you, that would be great.
I mean, in work terms, I'm thinking quite a lot about the relationship between the education system and inequality in cultural and creative jobs. And that's partially what I'm doing for the British government, but it also feeds in to various other bits of work. I'm thinking about like the television industry and how people get jobs in that, thinking about how we value culture and heritage and where this maps into bits of education. In a sort of slightly tangential cultural studies way, I'm also very tense about football at the moment, but that's possibly for a different podcast.
You're tense about football.
Well, Liverpool play Manchester City on Sunday, which has got a real defining, possibly like league-winning match vibe about it. So yeah, quite.
Understood. Well, my preferred team, Leicester City, is still just leading the championship, but we are in on the naughty step in financial terms. And the accountants are coming for us, along with the pack of teams behind us. So we could be in the same place as your favourite team, Everton.
Yeah, I feel very sorry for the Blues. And again, actually, in cultural studies terms, there's a fascinating story to be told about the intersection of failures to regulate sport, media contracts, and then urban regeneration as well. Because part of the story that Everton have been saying is that we didn't blow all that money on terrible players. We spent it on a new stadium, which is transforming the north of Liverpool and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the most believable story, but it's the one they've got, so.
It's a story. And but for those of you not so interested in the English Premier League or even the Championship, let's move on to some of these other things that you mentioned, Dave. And to the extent that this is not talking out of school, could you tell us a bit more about the work you're doing on secondment?
Yeah, sure thing. So, the way the British system works is there are various research councils that fund research projects. And I think over the last 20 years or so, they've got really interested in how academic research can work with policymakers. So this is actually the second time I've been on secondment to the Ministry of Culture in the UK. Part of the, I'll get this wrong now, the United Kingdom Research and Innovation, I think is what the organization's called, but it's basically like the bit of the government that funds science. They funded over 40 of us in the last kind of year or so to go and do work within government departments. So I'm on this project that's about workforce skills and diversity, and I'm embedded with both a team of analysts in the Ministry of Culture, most of whom are kind of statisticians and economists, but also with a policy team who do skills policy for the creative industries. And it's incredibly interesting translating stuff. I guess the stuff that, say you and I as academics know, intimately, almost without thinking, in terms of how inequalities function, gender, racial pay gaps, why the film industry is so unequal, where money is in the theatre industry, all of these kind of things. Trying to embed that knowledge in a way that can be kind of useful when policymakers are thinking about funding decisions or, new frameworks for supporting education policies. Yeah, like doing lots of that. And I've got another year or so of doing this.
It sounds very interesting, and I imagine you're learning a bit from them as well as giving things to them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in terms of sort of my own work, it's been incredible. Like lots of us write about how policy is made, but I'm trying to think of an appropriate metaphor. You should never see how the sausage is made, but basically. So it's been, yeah, interesting to observe how kind of decisions get made, the pace of things, where evidence comes from, how it might be made more diverse, things like this. So yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating for me as well.
Now, speaking about the content of this work, you've mentioned inequality and diversity several times in the cultural sector and barriers there too, especially in education terms. Could you paint for us a bit of a picture of this inequality? You've been very good at contextualizing things, just to say that about 23, 24% of listeners are in the US, about 20% in the UK, and the rest split between all sorts of different countries. So if you could paint a picture for us of what you have to do to become a lovey and what a lovey is, that would be great.
I mean, maybe we could take a couple of high-profile, I guess, global stars as our examples. So, if you look at, say, someone like Idris Elba, who I kind of guess got his first big break in a US television show called The Wire, which is now probably about 20 years old, possibly slightly older. If you see any of his interviews, he tells a story of having basically to leave the UK because he wasn't really able to get very good parts. The UK's, I guess, kind of film and television system then was offering quite a narrow range of parts to, I guess, like he's a black leading man now, but what would have been a sort of an early career, just kind of coming through early career black actor. And the story of his career of kind of having to go to the US where there were a lot more parts available, some of them still quite kind of narrowly defined. So he famously plays a sort of ugly mobile drug dealer in The Wire. But then kind of coming back to the UK and getting more success because he had that sort of star quality, I think is a good example of how some of the racial inequalities work in film and television in Britain. The same is true of gender. So again, there's quite high profile women who've been involved in things like film and TV who have had to take kind of sideways steps to get on in their careers. And we see the same things with things like social class and disability as well. In the US, I guess your listeners will be familiar with. I think it's USC's the Annenberg Institute, which does a lot of quantitative research about how many women are on screen in Hollywood, how much speaking time they get every year. A bit like clockwork, there's controversy over the Oscars shortlist for best film, best director, which are inevitably sort of full of gender and racial inequalities. And then here in the UK, because the UK is kind of weird like this, there's also the obsession with social class. Not to say social class doesn't exist in the States, but I think the discourses are a bit different. So most of my work has kind of been in this space. And probably about a decade ago, I started writing about this with various colleagues. And then sort of 3 or 4 years ago, I slightly shifted from kind of what's the problem? Like academics are incredibly good at saying, look at all these problems. And then they kind of stop and say, either, well, we've told you what the problems are, it's not our business to solve them for you, or they'll do something which I, sort of quite strongly support, which is we basically need a massive social revolution to change all of these things. And I mean, that is true, in various countries, we need really serious social changes. But part of my work with colleagues here in London at King's College, but also with colleagues in Sheffield and Edinburgh, has basically been to kind of ask, so what kind of things could organisations do if they wanted to diversify their workforce or diversify their commissions? And the sort of most recent iteration of that, sorry, this is a really long answer,
No, go ahead. It's great.
is basically looking at the relationship between kind of how the education system functions and how these questions of diversity come up. We found doing basically they were kind of focus groups for some policy work about how creative organizations can diversify their workforce. We found a lot of comments like, it's not really our problem, it's the education system. We can only employ, the people we kind of encounter. We did some research quite recently, basically showing that almost all of the people who get employed in Britain's creative economy, and it's very similar, if I've understood the data correctly, in the US and in Australia as well, they're almost all graduates. So, universities are the kind of crucial routes in. And obviously, who goes to university is not diverse. There are significant inequalities. The type of university they go to, and the type of course they go to, there are really kind of serious inequalities there. And again, this is the same kind of across the Anglosphere, I guess. In the US system, there were really obvious inequalities of who goes to Harvard versus who goes to a local community college. So in the British context, we've been trying to think, and there's kind of five or six of us working on this. What would universities have to do differently? And are there any kind of alternatives to university as well?
Question about diversity. When I read in the Groniad, a sort of biblical object for people like me, but not only me, about the need for diversity in, say, British publishing or British television or theatre, my problem is that diversity seems to mean women and people of colour who are from the former British Empire. It doesn't seem to mean Poles. It doesn't seem to mean French. It doesn't seem to mean Chinese. It doesn't seem to mean the hundreds of thousands of Colombians and Brazilians who clean London offices at 3:30 every morning. And one of the great failures that led to Brexit, in my view, was that none of those people, perhaps most significantly the Poles and the French, were ever really addressed by institutions like the BBC in any serious way. And it seems to me, as an outsider and an amateur, that the definition of diversity remains too narrow. It's too dependent on an imperial and Commonwealth view of the world. I may be completely wrong. Could you give me a response to that assertion on my part, Dave?
No, I think you're clearly onto something, and I think I'll try maybe unpack it in quite short ways. I think there's a sort of a responsibility by the kind of social science end of cultural studies for some of that. So I think part of what you're describing is effectively a kind of an artifact of measurement tools. So in Britain, maybe I'll do a focus on social class. In the last 10 years, we've been able to get quite a lot of data about the social class origins of the workforce for various reasons, using various data sets. And this really doesn't interact well with immigration, whether it's from the EU, which Britain used to be part of, or from other parts of the world. And one of the kind of challenges for people interested in social class, social mobility, is, well, how do you think about not just say a Colombian cleaner, but a French medical student who's come to be a doctor, and then, well, what about a Polish medical student who's come to be a doctor? What about someone who used to be a doctor in Afghanistan and is now a cleaner? in the UK. And there's lots of debates in the literature about immigration and its intersection with social class. But what we've found, and again, you know, sort of this is a problem and a failure in my work, is we kind of bracket that off as a way of saying, well, that's kind of complicated. We're not quite sure if, you know, the data kind of works particularly well for that. But we'll concentrate on, you know, what we can do. And I think that this has also been, if you look at the kind of data regimes for reporting what's going on with publicly funded culture, immigration status isn't really in that conversation. There's a sort of prominent conversation about race, as you say, you know, through quite imperial sort of categories. There's a prominent conversation around geography, and there's a prominent conversation around disability. Gender figures a little bit, but not as much as I'd say as those three. So yeah, there's a kind of social science responsibility first. And then I think more broadly, you know, there is the, how would you describe it? You know, you've mentioned the sort of imperial racism of the British state, of who is viewed as a foreigner, who is constructed as, you know, as an other. That's changed over time. It's sort of no coincidence that in the, you know, that period of sort of 5 or 6 years building up to the Brexit referendum, there was a really kind of intense media scrutiny on sort of newer European nations. So what we call the old Central European, Eastern European countries. But, you know, you can draw lines back in time 100 years before it was the Irish who were constructed as this problem by the British press and this kind of thing. So yeah, I think there's sort of multiple issues and problems there. To come like all the way back to publishing, I think there's also a commercial question, which is sort of slightly different than, say, something like visual arts or theatre, which get a bit more state support in the UK. And the commercial question, and this is true actually in Hollywood, and there's quite a lot of evidence. Mariana Riega's book, which I can't remember, I think her data source was like the Panama Papers or the Sony leaks or something, where she got all this data about how executives would make these kind of gut reaction decisions about what will sell, what will find a market. And it turned out it was, you know, pretty kind of racist gut decisions. Publishing has also, you know, a lot of data, but it's got these kind of senses of this will find a market, that won't. There's quite a lot of work. So people like Onamik Sahar over here, but also Clayton Childress over in North America, I think he's at UBC now, have written about, you know, publishing has got these like ideal types that it wants to sell to. Usually a kind of educated white woman as the sort of ideal type. And yeah, there's very little discussion of where, you know, the Colombians or the French would figure in that sort of ideal type audience or ideal type reader, and then who would have to be different in terms of employment to kind of shift those gut reactions.
I take a point about a certain social science responsibility, but I do think it's also a responsibility of government and the media in general to look at these things. And I feel as though a lot of the anti-Polish volatility in parts of Britain in the run-up to Brexit was a sort of hidden element of this. You know, these guys are only here 4 nights a week. They all live together. They don't pay much. They're sending down our wages and so on. The attempts to integrate those folks, make them feel at home by institutions that are meant to do that sort of thing, like the BBC, were failing. At the same time as I really take your point and your frankness about the difficulty of people who slip between categories. If you have folks who are living in the country 4 nights a week, it is harder to get at them than if you have people who live in the country 345 days of the year,
I
right?
mean, there's a funny sort of, this is slightly tangential, but there's quite an amusing discussion about, so there's going to be an election in Britain at some point this year, or possibly as late as January of next year. And all of the polling is saying there's going to be a fairly catastrophic loss for the Conservative Party. But one of the problems, particularly of television media, is they tend to go and interview people on the streets. in the daytime who are by definition, not at work in the daytime. So you get this kind of big distance between vox pops that are largely with pensioners, sometimes with mums with school kids, but largely with pensioners, who will have attitudes that sometimes mirror the bulk of the population, but sometimes are way, way off. And you get this, kind of sense of, but we've been speaking to these people and they're saying these, what we'd think of as like fairly terrifying comments about immigration or their views on Brexit and stuff like this, whilst the rest of the country, according to social science polling, is saying we're not interested in anything like that anymore. So yeah, like I think you can observe this with a lot of sort of media discourses actually, and those again. Some of this is an ideological thing, but a lot of it is the, I don't know what you call it, the kind of, whether you'd be as grand as to say the political economy of production, it's really difficult to go and interview people in their homes if they've just come in from
Line
work.
things
If,
up. And one
yeah.
of the issues here is also that so many journalists and lots of academics read a torrent of remarks on X, the former Twitter, or Facebook, and think that that's public opinion when it's not a random sample. So I feel as though the need to explain how random samples work is actually fundamental, although it's not exactly going to be as interesting as Liverpool versus Manchester City. But also, it seems to me there's a problem here because opinion polling, although it is fetishized in the advertising world and in sophology, is often derided because it often gets things wrong in elections. But because it gets things wrong in elections, doesn't mean it gets things wrong when it comes to more generalized opinions. Often because the opinion polling we get is not done by social scientists. It's actually done by private research organizations that sometimes use proper random samples and sometimes really don't. Plus, often it can be the case that when people are asked an electoral question, they answer it very differently from how they answer a whole bunch of questions about attitudes. Yeah?
Yeah, and again, it's sort of fascinating to live through exactly what you've been describing. So I guess actually for people listening in the States, they're living through this slightly kind of strange moment where all of the polls are saying, it's very close. I mean, certain swing states, Trump is probably going to take it. Whilst at the same time, as far as I can tell, many of the kind of recent elections have been quite good for the Democrats and have really not, sort of fit well with the polls. Here, I think there've been these kind of various moments where the polls or the polling industry, let's call it, really didn't get it right. And I guess for those of us who are academics who follow, the kind of sophologist end of academia, we take this as like, well, yes, of course, polls are a snapshot. There are various kind of issues with them. But obviously media discourses have, they will news will report newsworthy things. And here is a series of, opinion polls that show basically the same thing is not newsworthy. Here is a random outlier, which probably has a methodological question associated with it. That will be, front page news. And what this has tended to produce is maybe two things recently. One is outlier polls that are either catastrophic for the Conservatives or moderately disastrous for the Conservatives, because no polls are good for them at the moment. And then focus groups where you will tease out particular opinions that don't seem to match the polls. So one of the things that's been interesting is the kind of cultural construction of who the median voter is. And I think we still see these discussions of Brexit voters in the north of England as being, probably conservative voting, having various kind of opinions again around immigration. But actually, if you look at where the kind of the numbers and recent elections, like local elections, they're all Labour voters now, and the idea of the median voter is probably someone who was quite a staunch conservative 5 years ago, and getting the ideology of the media to shift that. I mean, we can We're heavily into media now, aren't we? But the other thing in Britain is who runs the media. So British media is incredibly sort of narrowly controlled. Aside from one or two outliers, particularly the printed press are very, very conservative leaning. Printed press tend to sort of shape, if not dominate, BBC reporting, through morning programs, looking at what the newspaper headlines are saying and taking their cues from them. So there is this kind of, I can't remember who did this comparison, but and this is probably quite offensive and maybe, needs editing, but much like the Soviet press towards, the mid 1980s, where you'd have, everything is fine, comrades, and people would just be like, well, we're living this and it isn't. The budget this week, the press had various, there have been tax cuts and Britain is turning a corner and Brexit has been great for the economy and stuff. And people's everyday lives here are like, well, of course it isn't. That's ludicrous. So.
You mentioned regional questions briefly there, Dave, and this is one of the areas where there has been a certain and rather interesting address by the government to push the BBC to make Doctor Who in Wales, to push the poor bastards at Radio Bloke, to use its official title is Radio Bloke, but its unofficial title is Five Live, to go and live in Salford, to push Channel 4, which is a sort of private public mixture, to move to Leeds. Of course, no one is expected to move to Belfast. No one is expected to live in Somerset. You can hear lots of Northern Irish voices. You're not going to hear a lot of West Country ones or Leicester ones. But there is a notion that there had to be a devolution towards other parts of the country from London, within the BBC and within Channel 4 and so on. I wonder if you could speak to why that happened and what effects it seems to have had in terms of broadening the talent pool, in terms of making it more possible for a person in high school or later in college in Wales or in Manchester to gain access in a way that mightn't have been feasible 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question that, because there's a long sort of historical arc of, both the BBC and ITV to an extent, and then Channel 4 starts in the 1980s, of having these traditionally great regional bases,
Yes.
and famously so. So Liverpool, where I grew up, was part of the Granada Northwest Network, and one of the like morning television shows used to come from there, and like literally you could go down and watch it being filmed live and stuff like this, similarly with soaps as well. And then, I mean, I won't rehearse it all here, but basically 40 years of what the euphemism would be media reform, had centralized both television companies. I mean, Channel 4, the history is slightly different, particularly as it is slightly more of a commissioner than a sort of direct producer. But I think it's a sort of slightly strange story, because on the one hand, we've seen since the kind of late 70s, early 80s, just the relentless centralization of the British state in all forms. So whether it's, from like schools and education right the way through, to media and cultural policy. And some of the Conservative Party's kind of platform post-Brexit was this thing called levelling up, which I can say this because I said it to a parliamentary select committee when they asked me about it. It doesn't really mean anything. It's a fairly kind of hollow sort of agenda. Certainly recent internal government reports, which have been, quite sort of obviously public, have said, money that was earmarked to be spent has been not been spent, and the kind of success of whatever this sort of regeneration agenda meant has not really been realized. But as part of that, there was this push to, I suppose, kind of re-regionalize, because the idea of it being regionalized for the first time isn't correct, but re-regionalizing media production. I agree with you. I work at the University of Manchester. Manchester, has got this long kind of base for media production in the north of England. But, so did Leeds, so did Liverpool, to an extent, So did Newcastle. Bristol is probably like the final outpost before you get to the West Country, in terms of sort of media production. So yeah, it wasn't a sort of genuinely ambitious idea to push media production to the place where media production was kind of already happening. Now, part of one of the projects I'm working on is actually asking the question of what sort of opportunities get opened up when media production moves to different places. And I think one of the problems of just taking a sort of place-based solution to this question ignores the sort of quite high barriers to entry to getting into media industries now. We've got this curious moment where, on the one hand, we've got these discourses that say it's never been easier to get into media industries because, in theory, you can make a film with your phone, or you can edit in your bedroom, and these kinds of cliches that, people listening to this will be familiar with. But at the same time, when you look at the sort of composition of the media industries, particularly when you get into sort of commissioning levels, my colleague Sam Friedman has written quite a lot about this. The question becomes not, what sort of university did they go to? It becomes which Oxford College did they meet at? It's that narrow a sort of demographic. So I'm sort of, yes, quite cautious. I think what we're likely to see is much more like a sort of Manchester's middle class are more able to access media jobs without moving to London, rather than, the broad kind of population of the Northwest are more able to enter the media industries. I mean, you're right in terms of the accents you hear are different now because the Vox Pops are no longer just done in that bit of West London where the BBC used to be. But at the same time, which is good in terms of representation and stuff like that. But just on its own, these spatial or place-based fixes are not effective.
Not enough. And I wonder if I could ask you also about theatre, Dave, because on the one hand, the hyper-commercial West End world in London is enormously successful at attracting people from all over Britain who love to go there and see a famous musical or whatever, and from around the globe. On the other hand, regional theatre has always been extremely strong, organically and with cultural policy support, much of it very local. Much of it agitprop, extremely politicized and rich. How is that faring at the moment in terms of the inequality issues that we've discussed, of disability, of gender, of race, of class?
Really badly is the sort of sad short answer. So I think Britain is living through a sort of genuine crisis for regional arts organisations, mostly driven by central government's decision to very brutally cut direct funding to local authorities. This will get boring very quickly, but basically, the way tax works here is not very sane when it comes to local taxation. So local, like cities and councils, unlike in the States, but also like unlike all over continental Europe as well, really don't have very strong tax bases. And most of sort of funding questions really run through central government, run through Whitehall. And these funding reductions, I think, were the kind of things that were thought of as easy cuts to make by both the 2010 coalition, but subsequently as well. So like this week and in the past 10 days, we've seen Birmingham City Council, which is the, I think it's like either the second or the first biggest metropolitan district in Europe, cut all of its cultural funding because it's effective, like local authorities here can't go bankrupt, but it's effectively gone bankrupt. Nottingham is doing the same. If I recall correctly, there were issues in various bits of the southeast and the south coast. Other places have tried to kind of, I suppose, defend their cultural funding, but obviously are reducing it because they're getting less money from central government. And I think there is quite a stark contrast now between, on the one hand, almost the emergence of a kind of DIY approach to regional theatre production because of the, really serious kind of collapse of local authority support, even where those local authorities are very kind of supportive and, very sort of understanding of cultural policy. And then, yeah, a phenomenal export industry that is the West End. But at the same time, the West End, there were, if there weren't strikes, I think there were, sort of, they came quite close to a strike over pay. The inflation crisis here, I think West End theatre productions responded sort of slowly or slower than they needed to. And the union here, Equity, was very kind of vocal about, even the kind of high profile successes, it's still difficult to make a living. So yeah, everything I've said about theatre is true of visual arts and, the museums here as well.
You've mentioned export there, and one of the few things apart from bombs and English that Britain exports successfully is culture. And yet, despite the fact that education is one of the pathways towards its production, we have a populist trend in the current government, but it was true of the previous Labour government too, that says that studying the arts is valueless and Mickey Mouse and not serious. And it's easy to mock this, but I get confused by, on the one hand, economistic arguments for the value of culture that are made all the time by all these governments, and on the other hand, their desire to demonize those who study and teach such things on the grounds that they should all be studying things that are much more expensive to teach, much more expensive to learn, and much less significant in terms of Britain's balance of trade. Where, can you explain that sort of imbalance if I've got it right?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll say three things. One is I think you have to kind of pin down the particular sort of ideological positions that relate to this. So even within the Conservative government, which has done, which has really like leaned in heavily to the worst kind of rhetorical aspects of being anti-higher education. There are dissenting voices, who are very kind of great defenders of Britain's HE system, including its arts and humanities. So I think it's important to sort of understand the landscape a bit. The second thing
Yes,
is
yes.
one of the things that has gone on really since the last major kind of set piece of higher education policy, which was basically changing the fee regime. Is there hasn't been much higher education policy other than a lot of rhetoric. So there's been lots of, about free speech on campus. There's been a lot of stuff about, and the terms have changed because, these are not accurate terms. But, the current thing is a fear of like, woke degrees or whatever. But, like 10 years ago, it would have been political correctness still. And, these kind of rhetorical tropes. And whilst there's been a lot of, living through this as an academic is extremely kind of tiring. But when you look kind of under the bonnet of, so what legislation has come through, what policy is there? Like, there's been, a struggle to by the Tories to get stuff on the statute book. And what this means is that the sector has been essentially kind of adrift without a policy framework for about a decade. And much of the kind of space where policy should be, policy like what kind of subject mix would we like, or should we fund new medicine schools, or should we, invest in like attracting more foreign students, or all these kind of things have basically just been sort of sidelined while ministers have mainly in the kind of Telegraph, Times, Daily Mail. Which are the most sort of conservative newspapers have basically just said things that are like relentlessly untrue about the sector, culminating this week, and this was very prominent in the current science minister basically having to pay a social scientist because she defamed her on Twitter on X. And science minister has not resigned, which is remarkable, for a sort of sitting politician to be defaming people and then keeping their jobs. And I guess that's an example of, the sort of state of things, the gap between the rhetoric and the reality. In terms of, yeah, the Mickey Mouseness, so one of the other things that's happened because of the lack of policy intervention is the market has spoken, and undergraduates still want to study arts and humanities courses. There are big issues about where they want to study. There are big issues about the lack of coordination in the system. There are massive problems about certain institutions at one end of the system, massively expanding to deal with the funding crisis at the expense of others. But looking at various kind of, and I'm doing some research work on this, looking at various things like, surveys of undergraduates when they enter the university system, the stickiest kind of most committed people seem to be medics and people who want to study the arts. They're like the two who are like, we just really, we're really up for this. We really want to kind of do these subjects. So even despite a decade of really offensive rhetoric, a decade of policy drift, the demand is still there. The question is how the funding regime is going to work. And again, coming back to the Pravda kind of nature of British media at the moment, the two worlds of op-eds and then actual student demand are like a million miles apart from each other.
And I guess the other thing is, and this is true of governments everywhere, they crap on about wanting the direction of education to be demand driven, but they don't like what students actually want to study.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The one of the things I've been looking at, there was some good work done by the University and College Admissions System. I can't remember what UCAS stands for, but like basically the organisation that deals with admissions here. And art students were telling them, they were kind of the least likely to care about career outcomes and, sort of like wages and, sort of financial outcomes from their degrees, which we know, but obviously, like, this is not great for the government, who says all you should care about when you're making your education choices are these things. So you've got a cohort of whatever it is, I think it's about 180,000, but I can't quite remember off the top of my head, of these undergraduates who, are most committed to their subjects and don't care about, the kind of money they're going to make, which, yeah, is what the government wanted for the system. But obviously, they really don't like the consequences.
This is the problem for neoliberalism as a practice, constantly referring to demand being the thing that drives everything, but being extremely unhappy with the results that it produces over and over and over
I mean,
again.
I think there are practical questions that you mentioned, the kind of the economistic frameworks that I'm moderately sympathetic to, or perhaps more sympathetic than you are to. And there is a question of like, well, how do we pay for this? Particularly Britain's system has a kind of weird accounting system where it thinks about how much student kind of funding costs and when it will be paid for, and stuff like this, which is different again to the US system because the states involvement. And those, I suppose, technical questions are ones that none of the kind of key political actors want to touch, whilst at the same time, the system has produced wonderful opportunities for various politicians to say ridiculous and offensive things, which have kept them, on the front pages of newspapers, have given them, talk shows on the equivalent of Fox in the UK, etc. So, maybe some of them have got what they wanted, but in an, unplanned and unconspiratorial way.
Prof Dave, I've got a couple more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything that you want, to our discussion.
Yeah, of course.
First one is to ask you about the magic elixir, or is it a Kool-Aid, called creative industries, and its relationship as a concept to cultural industries. because the claims made for creative industries have been exorbitant in Britain for years now and appear to be accepted on a bipartisan basis. And they've been exported successfully to other countries, as you know. But there seems to be a bit of a backlash against this. And there also seems to be some ongoing confusion about how we distinguish or don't creative from cultural industries. Could you help us out in terms of the success or otherwise of the term as a policy formation and how to distinguish it from culture?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not that bothered about this distinction, partially because, I'd argue both the kind of cultural and the creative industries have, histories that you can tell. There's no such thing as a kind of natural concept. There are sort of histories and lineages we can unpack. I think one of the problems with creative industries that I think has not been solved, and people are right to take issue with, is less to do with the conflation of, say, artistic production and then commerce, but is more to do with how certain things that are really, not artistic or cultural in any way have been conflated with things that are artistic and cultural. So there's been an ongoing sort of academic literature about the way that, most kinds of sort of IT consultancy are not really artistic or cultural jobs. Video game design and stuff, that makes sense. And a lot of the economic action, particularly in the UK, has been precisely in things like IT consultancy, database design, these kind of things. And so a lot of the economic rhetoric has been really heavily inflated by those sectors, which is a shame because, film, advertising, we've mentioned you can be incredibly kind of commercially successful in theatre, in continental Europe, where, funding regimes are different. You can have, very sort of well-paid jobs working in galleries, certainly in commercial arts, you can make a lot of money. And as, people like Dave Hesbenhage have argued, and others, these are like good jobs as well, if they're sort of done well in sort of supportive environments. So it's a shame in a way that that kind of moment of database design has been conflated with cultural production. But at the same time, I'm sort of tomato tomato about, I think we could call a cluster of artistic and cultural occupations and industries as creative industries, as much as we call them cultural industries. Although I know there are sort of various kind of positions in the academic literature that would be like horrified by that, would be like, absolutely not. I think the other sort of problem is the Florida problem, which, famously, this professor Richard Florida writes The Rise of the Creative Class, which proves to be really influential. It's a really good example of the kind of lack of coherence of a category, because the creative class seemed to include like everybody who like was doing white collar work, basically. And the influence of that and the various sort of quite daft sort of policy prescriptions that came for various cities around the world, I think, has been sort of another layer of the problem of creative industries, because they get conflated with creative class.
Yes, I find I think that's very helpful. And my last question before handing over to you, Prof, is this one. How do you find things out?
How do I find things out? I don't know. That's a really good question. Probably I ask the people that I work with. So basically, I like this conversation, like by default, by its, sort of genre, is you and I chatting. But I've sort of alluded to various kind of people I'm working with, and I probably use the royal we several times as well. But basically, like, I'm really lucky to work in these incredible networks of people. who have like, much more sort of expertise than I do. And then other than that, I'd probably Google it. So that'd be the other way. But yeah, that you've thrown me with that one. I really don't know.
No, I probably should have made the question a bit broader, but I appreciate the answer because it does help us to realize that we stand on the shoulders of giants and we stand next to giants, and there are lots of giants. And there are, I mean, and giantism is an unfortunate metaphor for me to have used, but I mean it to imply people with lots to offer. And
Yeah,
so
look,
I appreciate your saying that.
I'm incredibly lucky in that sense. So like everything we've talked about today is either, based on, a really good bit of academic research I've read that a colleague, has written, or something that, I've been part of as a big team. So all the kind of creative diversity stuff, the what works stuff, that is, several universities, lots of different academics, some early career academics, helping us out. Others, who are more established, working more formally. So yeah, the sort of the joy actually of academic networks is probably how I find stuff.
And the pleasures as well as the perils of collaboration, I guess.
Well, yeah, there is that kind of herding cats moment when, us as academics try and work together, but
Are
it's
you
mostly
more the pussycat or the herder, Dave?
It depends what we're writing. I've been various kind of pussycat moments this past week working on a policy report that my colleague Mark Taylor has basically done the legwork and certainly done all the analysis for it. So
And finally, if I could ask you whether there are things you'd like to add to what we've discussed, Prof.
I like this will sound like a sort of bit of a joke, but nothing I've said could be construed in any way as, a formal policy platform for the British government. And I'm speaking in a personal capacity at all times. And I sort of say that jokingly, but I probably do have to add that. And
You can
then.
see that, as opposed to that, from my sweatshirt, everything I say is endorsed by scientific Marxism.
But otherwise, the sort of the interesting question that I have is like, how is it different in other places? Because again, most of the stuff we've talked about, I've had a kind of, this is how it is in Britain. I've got, a little bit of knowledge about the States, continental Europe, and to an extent, Australia. But thinking about how these issues play out in whether it's China or other bits of Southeast Asia, Latin America, like, yeah, I'm sort of both interested and slightly clueless about that. And it'd be fascinating to know more.
Well, maybe some of the research projects you've done can be expanded to be more international. One way of getting them funded would be to pitch them in terms of significance of the export of British culture to A, B, or P country. But I think that there's a lot to be done, and of course, it's a patchwork story, especially in very big countries, and a patchwork story in terms also of the role of the state, which is obviously very large in places that, for example, had traditions of public broadcasting, like you get in very good ways in Northern Europe and Western Europe, but is very different in what are more authoritarian states historically, and also very different in places like Latin America, which, whether they've been authoritarian or democratic, and they've been both in many instances, rarely have had a rich public broadcasting undergirding in the way that a Norway or a Britain have had. And they've also had things like publishing industries that were very much dominated by colonial power. So just as British publishers are very important in the Anglo world, mostly but not entirely outside the US, so publishers in Spanish of books are mostly owned here in Spain, where I'm speaking to you from, for example. And also, of course, when we talk about some of these regions, there's a big difference because, as is the case in Western Europe, some of these countries are tiny and some of them are huge. And so you get different traditions. Plus, if they're migrant countries, you get different traditions of mixed race, indigeneity, and white corporate power. So that's why I think it could be very interesting to pick up some of the models and the knowledge that you guys have gained and looked at it elsewhere. The way to get the lot, the loot, as I say, might be to say it's about how to sell British culture around the world, even though everybody knows that it does that quite nicely. Thank you. But I do think it's very important to do more of this comparative work because there's a lot of data available about Britain, a lot of data available about the EU, but it's much patchier elsewhere, I think. Anyway, I mean, I shouldn't be I'm telling this to the podcast audience. You already know all of that. But thank you very much, Prof. Dave. It's always really an educational experience for me to talk to you, to learn from you, and to gossip with you. So many, many, many thanks.
Hey, thank you.